During these last few days, a striking prophecy in the book of Isaiah has been very much in my mind. The scene is a small Palestinian town in the 8th pre-Christian century. It's nightfall, nighttime. There is a large defensive wall around this village, and on the parapet there's the town guard. One of the citizens is abroad late in the night, and he calls up to the guard, Shomer Mami Laila, Shomer Mami Leil. Watchman, what of the night? Watchman, what of the night? The guard looks out, and all is quiet. He looks across the valley to the near mountains, and he sees there the first lightning, the first suspicion of a lightning of the dawn. He has a sense that this town will soon be free of the dangers that lurk in the shadows. And he calls back to the citizen who has asked him of the news, Asu Boker Vagam Laila. The morning comes, but also the night. For somehow in the first suspicion of the dawn, he senses the darkness of the next evening. Sunday last, we had the suspicion of a dawn. There were no negotiations, there was no conference, there was no meeting, but in the president's speech, we sensed the first lightening of that darkness we call Vietnam. But somehow, hope and despair are inextricably intertwined. By the end of the week, a single shot, single death, plunged this nation into a paroxysm of fear, grief, violence. Friday morning, I had been invited to speak at Baldwin Wallace College as part of a symposium on the humanities and the moral revolution. The symposium was opened Thursday evening by the mayor, by the columnist Carl Rowan. It had been a very emotional meeting. In the middle of one of the speeches, the news had been brought up of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s murder, and the meeting had really disbanded before anyone could begin to assimilate what had happened. Dr. Bonds, the president of Baldwin Wallace, called me up late that night and asked me, in these words, could I give meaning to this death? I was to be the first speaker the next morning. And I realized, even as we spoke, how different were the environments which had conditioned us. In his environment, in the Christian environment, death instinctively must have some meaning. Death is redemptive. Death brings salvation. In our tradition, death is a tragedy. It's the end of life. It doesn't bring anything that's new into the world. What does the Bible say? The dead praise not God. Better a live dog than a dead lion. Death is a tragedy. This kind of senseless death. It's an unrelieved and unmitigated tragedy, not only for the man and his family, but for the nation. Could I give meaning to this death? Somehow we romantically assume that death transmutes into memory and that memory is compelling and that we are the better, purified and purged for another man's death. That's nonsense. Nonsense. Death changes a man into memories, the things that he leaves behind. And many of these memories are compelling. Dr. King was an unusual man, man of rare spirit, a great heart, fine wisdom, sensitive man. He had an ability to bring out an understanding of the larger horizons of social change among those whose horizons are usually narrow. He had the ability to lead his followers into a greater courage than they knew they themselves possessed. But now his life is simply a memory. And some men will read that memory and read into it his own philosophy of nonviolence and perhaps lead less violent lives themselves. But other men will read that life and read into his nonviolence whatever they wish to read in it. His speeches will become a proof text for the saint and for the devil. And he has no control over the use to which his words or his memories are placed. The dead praise not God. The living can change history. But the dead can only change history insofar as those who invoke their memory invoke it honestly and within the context, the spirit in which those whom they claim as master lived. As I spoke to Dr. Bond, I sensed for the first time, really, the meaning of the conclusion of the prophecy with which I began. Let me quote to you the whole short prophecy. Shomer mami laila, shomer mami leil. Watchman, what of the night? Watchman, what of the night? Amar shomer, the watchman responds. Asa voker v'gam laila, the morning comes and also the night. Im tiva'ayun v'ayu, shuvu v'esayu. If you really want to know more, come later and ask again. Death, the dawn, the dusk, the light, the darkness, any event has no meaning at the moment. It has meaning only insofar as we give it meaning. Only insofar as those who survive transmute memory to act, devotion to the dead into deed. If we want to know whether Dr. King's death has any meaning, we can't know it now. We'll know it only 6 months from now, a year from now, a decade from now, when we find out whether this nation has truly come to grips with the problems of racial injustice and civic strife and violence against which he preached and to whose solution he devoted his life. And my mind went back to another senseless death, Dallas, 4.5 years ago. Now remember the many eulogies that were spoken, the many emotional commitments that were made. How many were going to work at the very extremities of the new frontier, on the streets, in the slums, in the Peace Corps? How many were not going to ask what the country could do for them, but what they could do for their nation? How many? And how many were really able to break the habits of a lifetime? The narrow, circumscribing patterns into which they had grown accustomed. It's amazing how quickly resolution dissolves and melts away when the first sunlit day, the first day comes when we are no longer burdened by grief. You remember 4.5 years ago? This nation made a resolution, or seemed to put an end to violence. After all, the president had been shot down by the kind of weapons that were available in every store in every city of the land. 4.5 years later, is there a law requiring the registration of firearms? 4.5 years later, is there a law which prohibits mail order houses to sell to anyone guns and live ammunition? 4.5 years later, have mothers ceased to buy for their children toy arsenals to condition them to rifles and to guns? I read just 3 weeks ago of a reporter in Detroit who went into a surplus army store and he bought a bazooka, a mortar, and a 2.5-inch cannon and live ammunition. All of it was an operative order. Did we really, really take this nation in hand and diffuse some of the poison of violence? I submit we went about our way. We quickly forgot our resolution, most of us. The rate of violence has increased almost geometrically since the death of President Kennedy. We didn't blunt it. We didn't lessen it. Dr. King's death Thursday last was one of only 250 murders that night across our nation. In a short speech Thursday night, the president said that we must deny to violence its victory. And I agree. But if denying violence its victory means simply that we must track down and book and convict the assassin and his accomplices, I submit that we will not have denied violence its victory. Now, the assassin should be tracked down and should be brought to jail and he should be convicted and he should be sentenced, if only to prove that there is a law far greater than the prejudices of the white police force of Memphis. But will that deny violence its victory? Will that calm this nation of ours? Will that bring safety to our streets, justice to the ghetto? I doubt it. I really doubt it. Am I cynical to believe that this nation will again compound the tragedy of as it did at Dallas? We have an amazing capacity, you and I, to narrow the focus so that we forget issue is all about. The real tragedy of Dallas, besides the death of the president, was that we became preoccupied with Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby and the Warren Commission report. How many books were written and articles, pens, and speeches made on to whether there were two bullets or three, one assassin or two, whether Oswald had accomplices or not, whether the Warren Commission had hidden information from us or not, and it's all trivial. The president was dead, he couldn't be revived. Two men had died, perhaps some others should be in jail, but that wasn't what the public crime was all about. We narrowed the focus. We became preoccupied with the trivial because it was more convenient to do so. We were able to forget that the real issue in Dallas was that Dallas was at that moment a symbol of a violent nation, a nation which was being ripped apart into extreme camps, a nation which was undergoing hate, fear, prejudice, roiling communities, and which was doing precious little to solve the basic civic problems with which it was faced. Am I cynical to believe that Dr. King's death will probably not be able to bring about new legislation requiring the registration of firearms? President Kennedy's death couldn't do it, and Dr. King's. Am I cynical to believe that Dr. King's death will not bring a sizable new orientation to the civil rights legislation now before Congress? President has made his soundings, and he has already found that he has had to delay his speech to the joint sessions, and the reporters are already speaking that in those soundings he found resistance. That only to open housing legislation, which costs no one anything, it is simply a statement of justice, but especially to the larger implications of what the president apparently hoped to speak about, the investment of the United States of its wealth and its citizens. Am I cynical to believe that this nation is not about to follow the recommendations of the Kerner Commission report on civil disorder to create a human budget of $60 billion, $70 billion a year, money which will renew our schools, provide for decent housing, provide for the kinds of human rehabilitation, provide for an adequate and dignified welfare program, such as alone can bring dignity and justice to us. Am I cynical? Perhaps I am, but I submit that there is very little in the immediate past history of our nation to justify any more romantic vision of the next few years. A man has died. Dr. King's death is a tragedy. Unrelieved, unmitigated, let there be no romantic nonsense beyond that. His death was, however, a public death, for he was gunned down because so many in our nation have condoned, you know, the singing of Dixie and the flag of the Confederacy and of all those 19th century prejudices and attitudes which are symbolized by a civil war that cannot be forgotten, by fears, racial fears, which cannot be overcome. He was gunned down because he was the spiritual general of a legion of people, of American citizens, who will no longer step off the sidewalk because some white boy insists that his ego be titillated, that his vanity be proven, be that he is the superior. And because his death is a public death, involves all of us. In a sense, all of us are involved. We did not pull the trigger. Ours is not the pathology of the assassin. Ours is not his guilt. But after all, what is American society than 200 million people like us? And why is there such violence in American society if in some ways we have not closed our eyes and turned away from many of the responsibilities of citizenship, which in our quieter moments we acknowledge? And why is there this bitter gulf of hate between the races? If we have not lived apart and away and forgotten and tried to overlook. The President's Commission on Civil Disorder, the Kerner Commission, began with a premise. And the premise with which began was simply this: that what the white people of the United States conveniently forget, and what the black people of the United States can never forget, is that the white community is inextricably involved in the creation and in the maintenance of our ghettos. And it came to a conclusion based on this premise, that our society was slowly being ripped apart into two camps, separate but unequal, one white, one black. And that the gulf between these two groups was growing visibly and perceptibly year by year. That every Watts, every Detroit riot, every Newark riot, every gunning down as of last Thursday night increases the separation of the races. But it added that any American committee must. That this division is not inevitable, irreversible. And violence is not the only way of life America can know. An armed confrontation between the white racist and the black racist. But there is another way. The way of decency. That is a way which will force every American to take stock of himself and to recognize that all we have done so far for the disadvantaged and the dispossessed is what the Negro civil rights leader calls tokenism. Very little, not enough, use whatever word you will. And what is needed now is not a skirmish with poverty, but a war on poverty. And what is needed now is not a program for 3,000 Cleveland Head Start youngsters, but for 30,000 Cleveland youngsters taking advantage of such a program. Then what is needed is not one half the budget per child per year in the city of Cleveland public school system, one half the budget of the suburban system, but a budget twice that or three times that of the suburban schools. What is needed is a crash program which involves the largest part of our national budget in human rehabilitation, in urban redevelopment, in the reconstruction of our educational system, in the guaranteeing of some kind of annual level of decency, in the destruction of this present welfare system, which is degrading and an indignity to those who must take part in it. The substitution of a system which will give them counseling and encouragement and the right to be a person. Now, when the Kerner Commission submitted its report 2 months ago, the president did not respond for 3 weeks. After all, Detroit and Newark had burnt last summer. How quickly memory fades. How quickly, when we put a dollar sign to all the words of the social gospel, how quickly when we put a dollar sign to all of the programs which need to be launched to establish these words we say so easily, justice, dignity, equal opportunity. How quickly when that dollar sign flashes up does it flash red and bring progress to a halt. Yes, there was a gold drain. Yes, there was an economic crisis. Yes, there was a war in Vietnam. And all of these were convenient reasons to put aside what must be, after all, the basic urgency of American life, the dignity of our own nation, the attitudes, the opportunities available to our own citizens. What's for it then? As in every human situation, there are two opportunities, there are two ways. There's no guesswork about it. No fumbling, no uncertainty. We can go on as we have been going on, and the racial tensions in our nation will become more and more exacerbated, and there will be more violence. And when a man says, burn, baby, burn, we won't be able to look him in the eye and say, you have no right to speak that way. Or we can take a new way and move from minimal programs of social rehabilitation to maximal ones. Shift the expenditures that we have been making from war to peace. From the destruction of human lives 5,000 miles from our shores to the reconstructions of human lives here and now. Very clear. It's all there. In the movie General de la Rovere, there's a scene in which late in 1945 in northern Italy, the Germans begin to receive serious defeats at the hands of the resistance movement. And they round up large numbers of people to separate out the resistance leaders. Well, this particular lieutenant of the SS rounded up a group of citizens in a town, and he found he couldn't separate out the men who were in the resistance from those who weren't. And so, in being a good German soldier, he decided he'd shoot them all. That night, as they were huddled in their jail cell awaiting the execution, one of the men who had not been in the resistance began to cry out, "I'm innocent, I haven't done it, I didn't do anything, I didn't do anything." And one of the officers of the resistance went up to him. He said, "You didn't do anything?" He said, "No, I didn't do anything." "You mean when the Germans came down and put their iron heel in our way of life, began to kill the aged and the infirm, and to round up the Jews and herd them away, and to defame and desecrate our churches, you didn't do anything?" He said, "No, I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything." He said, "Well then, if you didn't do anything, you deserve to die. Amen."